Have one case set for the 9 o'clock docket, and that is People versus Robinson. I see counselor here prepared to proceed, and I know the council have both argued here many times. I know you've already had a oral argument instruction and procedures given to you, so do you have any questions about that? No, I didn't think so. Okay, when you come to the podium, please identify yourself by name and attorney registration number. And for those in the audience, please turn off any cell phones or pagers so as not to interrupt the oral arguments. With that, we'll begin in People versus Robinson.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Rebecca Freire, Deputy State Public Defender. My registration number is 20010, and I'm appearing this morning on behalf of Mr. Robinson. It's my intention this morning to address the first issue in my brief, the third issue in the state's brief, and that's the Confrontation Clause issue as it relates to a non-testifying confidential informant's statements. Because Crawford and the ISIM, I'm not sure how to pronounce that Colorado case, because those cases say that testimonial statements only implicate the Confrontation Clause when they're offered for the truth of what they assert, the question in this case becomes whether the statements that came into Mr. Robinson's trial were in fact offered for their truth and argued for their truth, or whether, as the prosecutor and as the state argues now, they were simply offered to show why the car was stopped, why the police went to this particular location to look for this car. Because the law is clear that when testimonial statements are not offered for the truth, they can be offered for other legitimate purposes without violating the Confrontation Clause. So the question in this case then is, were they offered for the truth? And I think the federal cases that I cited in my brief provide some guidance on how to make that determination in cases involving non-testifying confidential informants. And what those cases say is, first of all, you have to look at how the evidence came in. How did the prosecutor present the evidence during the case? How was that evidence argued in closing argument? Was it argued as substantive evidence of guilt, or was it simply argued for the purpose stated?
Counsel, how does closing argument affect the earlier determination of whether evidence was admissible or not?
I don't think it affects the earlier determination. I think an appellate court, in trying to determine what this evidence was really used for, looks at the closing argument. Obviously, the judge, at least in our case, pre-trial, she said, yes, I think this is a proper purpose. The prosecutor laid out everything he intended to introduce, that the confidential informant had identified two targets as his drug sources, which I think was improper because there was no other evidence in the trial that there was any drug dealing except what came from the informant. And then the descriptions of who those what their names were, what they looked like, the identification procedure. And he said, I'm just using this to explain why the police stopped this car at this apartment complex. At that point, the judge didn't know what was going to be argued in closing argument. And I think she said, well, you know, the police don't operate in a vacuum and the jury needs to hear why they're at a particular location. But in closing argument, the prosecutor argued it as substantive evidence of guilt. And I think this court can look at those arguments in closing arguments. That's what all of these cases do, what appellate courts do, in deciding whether these statements were truly offered for the truth.
Well, is it, at that point, does it become a question of whether there was error in the when they were originally admitted and the court made its original ruling, or simply whether there's reversible error? Because here you had no objection to closing argument, you had no request for a limiting instruction. So aren't we then switching gears a little bit and looking at it from a different standpoint if we're looking at what was said during closing argument?
I do. I think that goes more to the prejudice analysis. I would agree with that. But I think the statements themselves, obviously, pre-trial, the judge doesn't know what's going to be coming in. and the judge doesn't know all the evidence the prosecutor is going to be presenting.
The judge had heard the suppression hearing, hadn't he?
No, you know, this case, it's funny because a different judge heard the suppression hearing. It was Judge Anderson that heard the suppression hearing. And then we had a different judge for the actual trial, and then we had a different judge for sentencing. So no, the judge had not heard the motions hearing.
Isn't the problem here the misuse of this information? You know, it could be for non-hearsay, it could be for hearsay. Isn't that a 403 real issue? It's kind of like, oh, wait a minute, you know, the jury might be confused. And isn't that a 403 objection?
I think it is also a 403 issue, but I think it's, as defense counsel stated, this is a confrontation issue. These are accusatory statements from a witness who isn't testifying at the trial, and that implicates the confrontation clause. And Crawford and some of these federal cases that I cited talk about how, you know, the rules of evidence don't trump the confrontation clause.
I thought you indicated they may be accusatory statements, but are accusatory statements necessarily always for the truth of the matter asserted?
They aren't. No, they're not always, but if that's the only evidence of that accusation in the trial, then it has to be. And if you look at this case, there was no evidence at all that my client, who was sitting in a car with the co-defendant, was involved in drug dealing. The only evidence of that was the CI's accusation that was his drug source, that's the person he identified as nephew. You couldn't tie any of that together without the CI's statements. He didn't testify, he'd never been cross-examined on that identification, and we know from especially the co-defendant's motions hearing that, you know, there were some problems with that. The CI had supposedly not seen nephew for a year, hadn't dealt with him for a year. As far as he knew, those two had broken up and hadn't been together for a long time. And we know from that motions hearing that the police, when they set up surveillance at that apartment complex, they're looking for a black male and a black Cadillac. They're not looking for two people together. They're certainly not looking for the tan Buick that the CI identified the two defendants in. So,
is it more of a sufficiency of the evidence issue, assuming that the identification evidence was allowed in for the estate purposes? Can it be used to sustain the sufficiency of the evidence for the conviction?
I don't think so. I don't think that it can. I think that if, in fact, there, and I'm not conceding, I don't think in this particular case the identification evidence comes in for a proper purpose. I don't see a proper purpose that it can come in except for the truth of it, because there was no other evidence introduced by the state of any identification. So the jury could not reasonably have relied on any other evidence in the case for the issue of identification except the hearsay, and that's an element of all the crimes that are charged, and that witness who made that identification wasn't there to be cross-examined. That's what it comes down to. But I think in the sufficiency analysis, if you follow the law and say, okay, you can't consider this for the truth as substantive evidence, then in the sufficiency analysis you can't consider it either.
Well, let me ask you can't consider it for the truth, but the police go to a reported location, and there's a report that people are involved in drug dealing. Regardless whether or not they could or couldn't have, they find drugs in those two people's car. Can you not infer that it's more than just coincidence that they're there with that amount of drugs?
Well, I think if you consider the hearsay statements, you can. The problem is the police only knew that there were potential people that could sell drugs from the confidential informant. The police only went to that location because the confidential informant told them, hey, in this 3:30 call, all of a sudden this male answers the phone and he says, I've got friends at this apartment, I'm going to be there, that's where it can happen. And in the co-defendant's motions hearing, the police formulate their plan after that 3 o'clock call. They don't have a plan before then. So it is this hearsay information that designates the location where all of this is going to happen. So I think it would be improper for the police to say, we set up a drug deal at this specific location. They can couch it in terms of this was our investigation to make it look like, you know, that's why we went there. But I think that's an improper purpose because they're using hearsay information to get there. And if you look at the direct examination of Detective Barrera, he starts talking about how I'm a narcotics detective and there are these three kinds of confidential informants we use. And the one in this case was the defendant confidential informant, and he came to me wanting to work off his case. And we had numerous conversations. We had numerous discussions about what he could do for the task force, and I sized him up. That's where I think the examination should have ended. And the prosecutor then should have said, well, based upon those numerous discussions with him, what did you do? We went over to this apartment complex, we stopped this car, and we arrested these two defendants. The jury would know. It's not in a vacuum that the police were involved in an investigation, and that's how they got to that specific location without telling the jury any of the hearsay information that implicated my client or the co-defendant as being involved in a drug deal. And then the case would have been the drugs that were recovered from the car, the fact that they were together, the fact that there were three cell phones that were in that car. But it would have been a completely different case.
Counsel, when this issue was argued to the court said, all right, I'm going to find that it sounds to me like this is not being offered for the truth. But then the court went on to say, but I'm going to put a tight rein around the prosecution and you really got to keep it limited. When you get to trial and the questions are asked, was there a contemporaneous objection at that time that the prosecution had gone too far? And if not, how does that play into our analysis?
Well, there wasn't. But I think the way it plays in is the prosecutor basically spelled out at that pretrial hearing, this is what I intend to get in. Okay, and what he introduced during Detective Barrera's direct examination were exactly those things. And so knowing the level of detail that the prosecutor said he was intending to elicit, then the court rules, okay? The court rules after hearing that list of facts. And the court does say, you know, I'm not gonna let you get into a lot of detail, but she never said, the level of detail you've just given me, I'm not going to let you get into that. I think the presumption was the prosecutor laid out what he intended to do. The court said, yeah, that's for a proper purpose. I don't know that defense counsel was on notice. Defense counsel had already argued. I think all of it's improper. I think all of it violates Crawford. So knowing what the court's ruling is, given the level of detail that she was provided before that ruling, I don't think that a contemporaneous objection would have limited it. And as we know from the Hearn case, which is factually very similar to this case, even with a limiting instruction in the harmlessness analysis, in that case, it didn't make any difference. In that case, the only evidence that the defendant was going to be dealing drugs was the CI's statement that he was intending to go to this rave party in Nashville to sell drugs. That was it. That was it. And the court said, you know, that's not harmless. That violates Crawford. That's a testimonial statement from a non-testifying witness. Now, would it have been better if counsel had objected? Yes. Would it have been better if there were limiting instructions? I don't know whether a limiting instruction would have made a difference in this case, because if you look at closing argument, the prosecutor argued in closing and rebuttal, all of this is substantive evidence of guilt. If you look at the argument on the MJOA, even the court considered some of this evidence, which she had previously ruled couldn't come in for the truth of the matter asserted, namely the specific location where this drug deal was going to go down, that the act of driving there was the overt act that was sufficient for the conspiracy. So everybody was thinking, everybody was using this evidence as substantive evidence of guilt, and it just violated his rights under the Confrontation Clause. All right, I will reserve my remaining time for rebuttal if there are no other questions.
Good
May it please the court, my name is Elizabeth Rohrbaugh. My attorney registration number is 24767, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado. This case presents the issue of out-of-court statements from an informant for the non-hearsay purpose of background information. In particular, I think counsel and I both agree that the question is, how much is too much when we talk about background information? And I'd like to quote briefly from the First Circuit case.
Would you agree if it's too much that it's a confrontation violation?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Would you agree if we were to conclude that it's too much detail that that would be a confrontation violation?
If this court finds that it's a confrontation violation, then the question becomes, is it in fact reversible error?
As I understood your initial statement, we agree that the question is, how much detail is too much detail? And my question to you was, if we were to conclude it was too much detail, is that a constitutional confrontation violation?
Well, I think we have to say, individually, when we talk about how much detail is too much detail, what is the information that was presented, and did it exceed that which is allowable for background information? Because even testimonial hearsay may be presented for a non-hearsay purpose and not run into Crawford difficulties. And I wanted to quote briefly from the First Circuit case of Mayer, which I think sums it up very well. The court said in Mayer, the dividing line often will not be clear between what is true background to explain police conduct and thus an exception to the hearsay rule and thus an exception to Crawford, and what is an attempt to evade Crawford and the normal restrictions on hearsay. But we are on firm ground in warning prosecutors of the risks they face in backdoor attempts to get statements by non-testifying confidential informants before a jury. So I think the question really is, what is a permissible background use of information, and what constitutes this sort of backdoor attempt to get otherwise inadmissible information in before the jury? And when we look at what's going on in this case, I think it's important to note, when we compare this case to the federal cases, that the informant in this case is no longer confidential. His name is Mr. Gutierrez. That is known by the time of the suppression hearing. That's clearly known at trial. He's clearly intended to testify at trial. He's been called a witness, and all of a sudden, the prosecution is caught up short. They intend to present the testimony of Mr. Gutierrez at trial. He doesn't show up. They have a warrant out for him. They say, we're looking for him. We will bring him in if, by some slim chance, we're actually able to find him and arrest him. But this is not a situation where there's this calculated effort by the prosecution to bring in statements from some unknown source. This is not that case.
What does it matter? He's unavailable. He's not there.
Well, Your Honor, I think it matters when we look at the purpose for which the information is being admitted. And I think it also matters because I think the problem identified by the federal courts in some of these cases is that there is this unidentified person who is making these accusations, which appears to be, excuse me, sir?
I thought it was statements out of court that they're concerned with.
Your Honor, when you look at the Silva case, for example, which is the case when Judge Easterbrook goes on a tirade in the Seventh Circuit, and one of his clear concerns is that this is a totally unidentified source, and thus there is no way to have a confrontation of this unidentified source.
How do you confront someone who's not in court?
Well, you can do so, and the defense did so in this case by introducing evidence through cross-examination of Detective Barrera in the possible shortcomings of the CI, identified as Gutierrez's, credibility. Namely, that he's been on probation, that he's been caught, that he's trying to work off his case, perhaps the officers have a reason to try and help him out because Gutierrez's mother is a police officer, that perhaps he's not a known confidential informant, so he doesn't have a track record. All of this is introduced through cross-examination.
So you're saying that, the actual cross-examination of the declarant itself is not necessary, as long as you can bring in evidence that would undermine the credibility of the declarant through some other source?
Your Honor, I think that clearly under Crawford, when we look at Crawford, there is the idea that, in fact, there has to be this in-court confrontation, and there was not in-court confrontation in this case. But I'm saying that I think that this case does have an important distinction with those cases where there is not an identified person who is making the accusations, because...
But doesn't that all go to the issue of harmless error if you get to whether this is testimonial and there's been a Crawford violation in the first place? How does any of that have anything to do with whether the testimony was hearsay in the first place? I mean, because if the answer to that is that it was hearsay, then you go on to another different analysis. If it wasn't hearsay, then that pretty much ends the matter right there. But everything you're talking about, it seems to me, just has to do with, was it harmless error if it was improperly admitted testimonial evidence?
Well, Your Honor, I think that it's important to look at what exactly was admitted in this case. And I agree, there are certain concerns that go to a harmless error analysis. One is the arguments of counsel. One is whether limiting instructions are given. One is whether proper objections are made contemporaneously. I agree that all of those things go to a harmless error analysis. And we look, and when we look at the possibility of confrontation, I think that that may also go to the question of whether there's been a Crawford violation. But I think it's important to look, yes, at the particular information that was admitted in this case, because as the court ruled, only some information, very, very limited, would be permitted as background. And it's very clear in this case that the prosecution lost a lot by Mr. Gutierrez not showing up for trial, because the court had ruled that the defendant's prior sales to the confidential informant would be admissible as 404B evidence. And the prosecutor clearly said, I know that I can't bring in the 404B evidence without Mr. Gutierrez testifying. The prosecutor also said, I know that I can't bring in the substance of these conversations between the defendant and Mr. Gutierrez. And the prosecutor did not do that.
What about the substance of the descriptions by Mr. Gutierrez, or the substance of Mr. Gutierrez's statement, that's them?
Your Honor, yes, I think there are three parts to what was admitted. The first, I think, constitutes background information that actually does not implicate the Mr. Gutierrez's statements. The officer testified, yes, at a certain point in time, at a certain place, this drug transaction was going to go down. This was our investigation. It involved two targets who were Dee and or Vanessa and nephew. I think all of that constitutes proper testimony, and it does not implicate the statements out of court of Gutierrez. And so I think that that is admissible for substantive purposes. I think the two things that are clearly hearsay statements are the physical descriptions of the two targets and the identification of the scene.
So that you're agreeing that those statements were admitted for the truth of the matter asserted?
No, Your Honor. How is that
going to be hearsay? Hearsay is truth of the matter asserted.
I'm saying that this is permissible background information under the facts and circumstances of this case. And I think, again, perhaps we want to look at the federal cases here. In particular, I think the Cromer case is one that is illuminating. Because in Cromer, the court clearly said that the background information that the particular person, Sean Cromer, was the subject of the investigation, and that a particular house had been identified as a drug dealing location, and the fact that they had gotten a court order to search the house was all permissible background information. Then it went on to have a discussion of the nickname of the defendant, because the confidential informant identified the person by the nickname of Nut. And The court said that this was, under the circumstances of that case, not permissible background information because, in fact, the jury had already been told, under the permissible background information, that the focus of the investigation was Cromer, and also that other witnesses had testified that Cromer's nickname was Nut or Peanut. And, in fact, the testifying witness testified that, this police officer witness testified that, in fact, the defendant's nickname was known as Nut. Now, we don't have that in this particular case. As I said, in Cromer, it was permissible to say the focus of the investigation was Sean Cromer. Now, we don't have that in the present case because the officers didn't, in fact, know the defendant's name. What we have is the officers know that the focus is this guy named Nephew. And so there isn't similar information that's redundant in saying that the defendant is, in fact, not a nephew, that he's always been known as Nephew. So it doesn't present the same problems in this case. With regard to the identification at the scene, there are two federal cases which involve the identification of the scene as I read them. The first was this Pew case where the witness had been shown a surveillance tape after the fact and had identified the defendant. So this took place not at the scene, but at some later point in time. So it was not actually a part of what was unfolding at the time. So I think that's different from the present case. I think the case that may, in fact, have the closest facts to the present case is the Rodriguez-Martinez case. And that case was like this case in that there had been phone calls between an informant and a source named Jorge for 15 kilos of drugs. And the informant was taken to the scene and actually identified at the scene the defendant saying, "That's Jorge." And in that case, it was actually conceded that that was testimonial hearsay, which should not have been admitted under Crawford. So that case involves a harmless error analysis, and the court found that it was reversible error. But in that case, there was more than one man in the van, which made it particularly damaging. In that case, there was not only Rodriguez Martinez, who was in the van, but also his girlfriend, his girlfriend's brother, and his girlfriend. So there were actually two couples and two men in the van. And so this out-of-court statement specifically fingered the defendant as the source. And we don't have similar confusion in the present case. In the present case, we know that, in fact, this is targeted at a couple. There is a couple in the car. There's one man in the car. And I think that the identification of the defendant by the confidential informant can be properly admitted as background information.
Let me ask you a question. There's been a lot of discussion by both counsel about federal cases. We've got some Colorado law, Tenorio and Banks, that pretty much lay out the black letter law about that we have here, but those are not informant cases. How important is it that this is an informant case rather than a case like Tenorio?
Well, I think
in terms of our analysis,
Your Honor, I think it gives this court some guidance from courts who have addressed similar issues.
But I take it there's no Colorado case from an appellate court in Colorado dealing with an informant fact situation like we have here.
Your Honor, I think this court, panels of this court may have addressed such an issue in unpublished cases, but I'm not aware of any published case on the topic. I see I'm quickly running out of time. I did want to emphasize that the informant was an identified person in this case, that he was intended to testify at trial, and that there was a full opportunity to cross-examine the officers concerning his credibility. I'd also like to note, for sufficiency purposes, that there was this linkage between the defendant and the co-defendant, because he gave her name as his next of kin and the cell phone numbers of one of the cell phones in the car when he was arrested. So that would go to the sufficiency analysis and show his linkage beyond just the drugs under his seat. I see I'm now out of time. I thank the court for its time and attention. I'd ask you to affirm the defendant's conviction.
Thank you, counsel.
I guess I want to start with the question about our informant cases different, and we don't have any in Colorado. And I think that they are different than the cases that we do have in Colorado, because the potential for abusing those statements and for using them for really using them as hearsay for the truth is greater. And I think that's what the Silva case talks about, that you can't just bring in hearsay statement after hearsay statement to explain the actions of every particular witness, because the confrontation clause is eviscerated at that point. I then want to turn to some of the other cases that the Attorney General talked about, and the Marr case, I think, is really distinguishable from this case because there was other evidence of guilt. First of all, they knew who the defendant was, and in our case, they didn't know who the defendant was. And in the Marr case, a DEA agent contacted Mr. Marr directly and set up a buy with him directly under the name of Sue. And so they had independent avenue of identifying him as a drug source, and the confidential informant's information was simply cumulative of that information. I see that I'm out of time. I would ask you to find a confrontation clause violation and reverse Mr. Robinson's convictions. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. And I take it both